These findings are now accumulating in such numbers that one can say definitely now the older conception of a unilinear history, which still dominates on the Vulgarian level in the form of epigonal constructions in the wake of Condorcet, Kant, Hegel and Marx, our public scene, is definitely dead. The field of mankind has become diversified. The differentiating developments are widely dispersed. The field can be characterized as pluralistic. The problem of a progress or a general advance of an imaginary abstraction mankind has dissolved in the various differentiating acts at the various points in time and space of concrete human beings. That does not completely exclude the construction of civilizational spread through cultural diffusion, but it removes the problem to a much earlier period. As Hentze once said to me in a conversation, when you have an historical background with articulate symbolizations of experience, for 50,000 years, anything can have happened in that time. And all that is later in the so-called historical period, after approximately 3000 BC, can be found by way of relations, must be always seen against that background of human social contact in such time spans. To give an example, we have, by now, an excellent literature on Polynesian cultures, their art, and their myths. What is sometimes not realized is the fact that the Polynesians did not spring from the earth on the Polynesian islands, but migrated there from the Asiatic mainland. And this migration to the Asiatic mainland has hardly begun before approximately the 8th century BC. So that before that time, for instance, the tribal developments, which today we call Polynesian, and the other tribal developments, which resulted in, for instance, the Chinese civilization, still belonged to the same level of culture. So that it is not surprising when, as again Hentze observes, one finds highly interesting parallels between ornaments of Polynesian origin and others which belong on vases of the Shang dynasty in China. From this splendid advance science in our time, one should not, however, infer rash expectations with regard to the depth of ideologies, a social effective. Advances of this kind have always been going on and have not made a dent in the ideologies. As a matter of fact, certain ideological propositions were developed in flat contradiction to ordinary historical facts well known at the time, and especially to the ideological thinkers. When Marx and Engels, for instance, begin their Communist Manifesto with the proposition, all social history hitherto has been the history of class struggle, they are talking impertinent nonsense, because there were, after all, such struggles in history, and well known to Marx and Engels from their high school days, as Persian Wars, or the conquest of Alexander, or the Peloponnesian War, or the Punic Wars, which all had definitely nothing to do whatsoever with any class struggles. Now, if one can make such propagandistic nonsense statements and get away with it for more than a century, one should not expect the expansion of our historical knowledge through science to make a dent in the corrupt existence of the epigonic successors of the ideologists in our own time. These last remarks, however, should not be understood as expressing a profound pessimism, which happens to be an 18th century mood and today somewhat anachronistic. Besides, the actual work in science that is going on all the time, in a splendid manner, and in which I try to participate as far as my powers of absorption permit, I had also 50 years of function as a teacher. My teaching experience started in high school, when, since we were very poor, I had to get some minimum pocket money by way of tutoring other high school students who were the children of more affluent parents, but did not match their material affluence with intelligence and industriousness. This kind of work continued until I reached university. When I started work on the university, I had the good luck of becoming a volunteer assistant in the Handelsvereinigung Ost. That's my commercial background. In the Handelsvereinigung Ost, an Austrian-Ukrainian enterprise that had grown out of the occupation of the Ukraine by the Central European armies during the First World War. One of the students whom I had to tutor was the son of the Secretary General of the Chamber of Commerce in Vienna, and he saw to it that I got that very low-paying job, which, however, enabled me to continue my studies. Very soon, when I got acquainted with professors through the seminars, they opened up the possibility of a teaching position with a very, very small salary at the Volkshochschule Wien-Volksheim, an adult education project sponsored by the socialist government of the city of Vienna, where the students were the intelligently more alert and industrious radicals from the workers' environment. I must stress the intellectually more alert because the less alert stratum of workers entering the political process was, of course, taken care of by the trade union training courses. So we had in that Volkshochschule something like a university for workers and certain lower middle class young people. In that environment, I learned to discuss and debate. At the time when I accepted a teaching job, I had already gone beyond my temporary 3 months Marxism in the summer of 1919 and was now facing there rather radical socialists, probably most of them outright communists. And since I had to deal with subject matters of political science and the history of ideas, immediately wild debates ensued, in which I could not give in or I would have lost my authority. On this occasion, during the years, developed a permanent good relation between the young radicals and myself, and I continued this kind of work after I came back from America and France in 1927 until I was removed through the National Socialism in 1938. So the conflicts between ideologists and my first attempts at being a scientifically oriented scholar were always strongly articulate. The personal relations were the best. And after the lecture and seminar hours in the evening, after 9 o'clock, all with the group got together and we continued the discussion in one of the numerous cafes of the neighborhood, coffee houses. I remember still, already in the 1930s, a scene where after a wild debate resulting in disagreement, one of these young fellows, not so very much younger than I was myself, with tears in his eyes assured me, "And when we come to power, we have to kill you." This little incident is perhaps the occasion for another anecdote which reflects the Austrian social climate very well. After the social democratic uprising in 1934, certain social democratic leaders were arrested and put into jail for a short while. Not for very long. But one of them, the famous Max Adler, their chief ideologist, was not arrested. That was a horrible blow to his self-esteem, because now he had attested by the government what everybody knew, that he was politically an entirely unimportant figure. And friends of Max Adler, who after all was a faculty colleague of mine, approached me on occasion whether I couldn't do something through my equally good relations to the other side to get him arrested for a little bit, so that he was not so terribly sad and downbroken. I actually talked with one of my colleagues, who at the same time was a high government official in the university, was teaching administrative law, whether the government couldn't arrest him at least for the 48 hours that were permitted under the habeas corpus provisions for anybody before one had to release him again. We talked about the matter, and he was very obliging and courteous and said he understood the situation of Max Adler perfectly well and since he was a colleague of his also in the same faculty, he would like to do what he could to accommodate him, but he was afraid one couldn't do anything because the government would make itself ridiculous, because everybody knew that Max Adler was unimportant. And so he declined to have him arrested. The good relations with these young radicals lasted well into the Nazi period and became even intensified until 1938, because everybody knew that if I wasn't a communist, I still less so was a National Socialist. And when then the blow of the occupation came, I was able to help some of them with letters of recommendation on their flight to safer areas like Sweden. In the University of Vienna, when I began to teach there as a Privatdozent in 1929, the relations with the students were fraught with more tensions, because the students came from middle-class homes, they were not workers, and the intellectually more intelligent ones were to a considerable degree affected by the German nationalism rampant in that middle class, combined with anti-Semitism. There were no open conflicts, but the relations were somewhat subdued, and I had to observe in 1938, when the National Socialist occupation came, that quite a number of the students which the day before I had had in my seminar on administrative procedure donned the black uniforms of the SS. Of a real experience of Central European university students as distinguished from young worker radicals, I can speak only from the years of my professorship in Munich from 1958 to 1969. As I had been called to Munich in order to organize a hitherto non-existent Institute for Political Science, I had to acquire, first of all, a couple of assistants who would help in the building up of an institute library and take care of the quite considerable number of students who flocked into the lecture courses and the seminars. From these beginnings was a number of completely empty rooms that gradually had to be filled with library shelves and books on these shelves, developed the institute that lasted until I left in 1969. Gradually a stock of students accumulated, who themselves became an educative force on other students who were attracted to political science, and gradually they could start on their own work for degrees. The result of these 11 years can only be described as a considerable success. In the first place, there was the institute as a physical establishment in which a first-rate library was built up, covering the new developments in the historical sciences, and not only in German, but above all in English and French. Special attention was given to the various areas which are basic for the understanding of Western culture, that is, to classic philosophy, Judaism, and Christianity. Then, of course, the sections of modern history and modern political ideas had to be brought, if possible, to completion at least of the principal works. And the new developments in prehistory, the ancient Near East, China and India, Africa, and the new archaeological discoveries had to be taken care of. The library became famous and was extensively used by young scholars from other fields because it was the best all-around library for the development of contemporary science. The young men also did well, and we developed a series of monographs representing the work of the institute. The most important of these series is Schriftenreihe zur Politik und Geschichte, published by the List Verlag in Munich, and now running into 10 volumes. Two more are planned to conclude the series. The areas and programs covered pertained to the work by Peter Weber Schaefer on Chinese Ecumene and by Peter Opitz on Tao Te Ching, aside from the, and by Peter von Sievers on Kalifat, Königtum und Verfall, die politische Theorie in Khalduns.